From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Michael Goldfarb, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Members of the House and the Senate have been talking tough on corporate conduct for the last few weeks. But what about wrongdoing among their colleagues on the Hill? Oh, sure, Trafficant went down and Torricelli was censured. But only after federal prosecutors or outside investigators produced a felony conviction or stacks of evidence. Otherwise, Democrats and Republicans have backed off from levying charges against the other side, living inside their own glass houses. In this hour, we're talking about Congress turning a blind eye on its ethical self. But we begin with scandals of the corporate kind. Federal investigators are turning up the heat in the insider trading case against Martha Stewart, and there were new revelations in the Enron debacle today. Randall Smith covers the securities industry for the Wall Street Journal. Earlier, I asked him, what's the latest on Marthagate?
Yes, there's more news about her communications between her and her broker right before she sold, and more indications that the she may have gotten substantial information about what other Implone shareholders were doing in terms of selling.
And she's actually going to be summoned to testify before Congress.
Congress wants her to sit there for their special brand of grilling, and which the Citigroup executives got in J.P. Morgan and Merrill Lynch last week. So the more star power they can get, the more coverage they'll get. So it's not that complex a calculation for them.
Does anything ever actually come out of these congressional grillings other than the extreme discomfiture of the executives who were, or possibly Martha Stewart, hauled up before them?
Well, I attended the Merrill hearings last week, and I was pretty impressed by the quality of the staff work that Senator Levin did, who's the Subcommittee on Investigations in the Senate. He really dug in and had done a lot of homework, and they spent a lot of time briefing him. And some of this, he obviously oversimplified some pretty complex accounting and coming to the conclusion that a Nigerian barge deal was a sham that Merrill did for Enron. But his knowledge of what had happened was pretty deep, and the stuff he said about it was pretty intelligent.
Now, let's turn to the another big scandal, and that's Enron.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are more details on sham dealings with Merrill Lynch. Can you explain it to us in layman's terms?
And it's odd because this one was not picked up by the congressional committee that did the hearing last week, but it was basically a sort of offsetting contracts between Merrill and Enron that resulted in Enron being able to book some earnings at the end of 1999, which was just around the time that right before some of the executives wanted to sell some stock, and the stock popped on the good earnings news, which this deal helped. And there were those within Enron who now say that was a sham. So more bad news for Merrill out of the Enron thing.
In your view, is this just a blip and it may not be as bad news as it seems, or do you think that there's something more profound here?
Well, I think in general, the sense of shock is sort of dissipating a little bit as the new news comes out. Ever since WorldCom, which, you know, was maybe 6 weeks ago, ever since the first shock of that, since the market has stabilized some and we've had some up days, I think there is a sense right this second that each new revelation is not as bad for investor confidence or the market itself as the stuff 2 months ago.
Well, then time is definitely on the side of these guys if they can string out the process by which various bits of alleged malfeasance are revealed. Eventually, the public will just get rather bored. And if and when they are actually brought up in federal court, then perhaps there won't be the same outcry that there might have been if it had all happened at once.
Well, I don't know about the all-at-once part, but definitely the outrage and the outcry are functions, the severity are functions of where is the market, and did the market go down 500 points yesterday, and people were extremely mad a month ago when the market was sort of acting at its worst, and it hasn't come back that much, so people are still pretty mad.
Within the Wall Street community, is there a sense that, you know, we've given up a few sacrificial lambs, we've had some photo opportunities of execs being led away in handcuffs, and that'll do us now? We can go back to business as usual?
Well, their stocks are way down below where they used to be. They're still laying people off. The underwriting volume is way down. So is merger volume. So they haven't gone back to happy days are here again.
But as individuals, I mean, do you get the sense as you cover the story that there's been an exhalation of breath in the collectivity of corporate America?
I think yes. I think the worst case scenario was that all the earnings in the S&P 500 were really only half what we thought they were, and everybody would change their mind about investing in stocks for their retirement. And neither of those has happened yet. There's still August 14th when all the CEOs have to certify their earnings, and you may get some bad news coming out of that, but that's only a week away.
Well, then we'll keep our ears pricked up for August 14th and our eyes open for those earnings reports. Randy Smith, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, Michael.
Randy Smith covers the securities industry for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke to us from New York City. We're talking tonight about whether Congress has turned a blind eye to corruption in its own ranks as it has been calling in corporate CEOs and carpeting them. On page one of yesterday's Washington Post, a story by reporter Jim Vandehei alleged that the House and the Senate operate on an unwritten contract which keeps them from probing for ethical investigations across party lines. On Point listeners, what part, if any, should partisan politics play in questions of ethics on the Hill? Congress has been strictly cracking down on corporate malfeasance in recent months, but should our representatives be taking a long, hard look at the way they themselves operate? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now is Jim Vandehei, who covers Congress for the Washington Post and whose article has sparked this conversation. Jim Vandehei, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me to the show.
Pleasure. Let's just jump right in. I mean, what evidence do you have that there really is this implied understanding between, among congressmen, not to uncover each other's underhanded dealings?
This has actually been pretty well known here among politicians for about the last 5 years. And it's basically an agreement by Republican and Democratic leaders, especially in the House, that they're not going to be political, or they're actually not even going to follow through on filing a lot of investigations into their own members. And the idea being is that both parties have always threatened to retaliate by, you know, sometimes doing purely politically motivated investigations, but also by just doing some serious investigations of members that really do deserve a looking into. I think there's at least five cases right now out there of members who there's accusations against, either for, you know, steering money to family members or for, you know, being heavy-handed with lobbyists and campaign contributors, that if you look at the House rules and House ethic laws, they deserve a looking at.
Now, you're saying that this has actually been around for a while. What was the history that brought about this, what, détente? Was it a truce?
It was, and a lot of people will tell you that it was probably necessary to at least have a cooling off period. In the late 80s, early 90s, the ethics process really became just a political firestorm. And if we can just step back for 1 second, lawmakers and at that time outside groups are allowed to call for ethics investigations whenever they can forward enough sort of evidence to the committee that warrants taking a look at. Well, what was happening is you had Newt Gingrich at the time, when the Republicans were in a minority, going after the Speaker of the House, then Jim Wright of Texas.
When was this again?
This was in the late 80s.
Late 80s.
And they would go after him with ethics complaint after ethics complaint, which some of them were warranted, but some of them were clearly politically motivated, meant to sort of create this perception that the Democratic Party and Jim Wright were totally corrupt. In the end, you know, Wright went down. And what happened was Newt became Speaker, and Democrats did the same thing to Newt. It was investigation after investigation, and there'd be retaliatory strikes from politicians. And it did get ugly. There was really a sort of this culture of just political warfare here, especially in the mid-1990s.
Now, we talk about investigations and investigations and investigations. Mm-hmm. Who's doing the investigating? I mean, are people, you know, leaking? I mean, disgruntled staff members on a Republican staff says, oh, God, the guy got a $25,000 gift from a lobbyist, and I don't like him. He didn't give me a raise. I'm running over to the Democrats, and I'm going to give them the correspondence on that. Or do they hire private investigators to get people? How does it work?
I mean, the problem is right now that there's very little of this investigating going on. How it does work, it can work in different ways. A lawmaker can simply call for an investigation based often on media reports, sometimes other investigations that were done by, say, the Justice Department. And then the Ethics Committee would take that material And they would launch their own investigation. They have their own investigators. They have their own lawyers that would take a look at this material and then determine if said member is in violation of health ethics rules. And if they are, they're punished, which can be a written punishment. It could be a reprimand. It could be expelling that member from the house, as just happened with Jim Trafficant.
Well, what do you think is the most interesting case being held in abeyance by this agreement between, say, Dick Gephardt and Dennis Hastert?
In contemporary terms, I think there's a couple. One is allegations against a Democrat, Paul Kanjorski, that through the years he steered a lot of government money to companies that benefit his nephews and his daughter. They're big investors in these companies. They clearly benefit from the money that he's steering to them. And it raises a concern among ethics watchdogs that he's using his position to, you know, benefit his family and, you know, some people.
And there's no, let me just be clear, there's no attempt by Representative Paul Kanjorski, Democrat of Pennsylvania, to kind of hide this activity. I mean, it's out front, it's up front.
Well, it wasn't hidden. I mean, basically, he wasn't out front about it until it was revealed in the local press. I mean, he wasn't out putting press releases saying I'm, you know, getting contracts for family members here. And I think the other interesting one is Tom DeLay. I mean, Democrats went as far as to file, you know, racketeering charges against him a couple of years ago because of his relationship with his former staff, some fundraisers, and some lobbyists that clearly skirted, you know, some of the campaign finance laws. And, you know, they felt so compelled to, you know, try to get the federal courts involved, but they didn't feel compelled enough to get the ethics committee to look into the allegations. I mean, that's sort of what raises a lot of questions in a lot of people's minds.
Now, is this, given that we're all focused more now on the kind of ethical lapses that exist in the top stratas of American mm-hmm. institutions, whether they be big corporations or the Congress, is there a sense that this is business that's going to need to be attended to, that the public is going to demand it, but that maybe because we're facing elections in a few months, that perhaps this is not a midterm election kind of effort. This should be something for a non-election year to be investigated.
I don't get a sense that there's any public outcry to look into any of these cases. For whatever reason, with the exception of a few ethics watchdogs like Gary Ruskin and a few reporters like myself and more so some guys at Roll Call, which is a newspaper here in Washington, very few people seem interested in keeping a close eye on the ethics of lawmakers. I guess the public, you look at polls, they pretty much think that all politicians are up to no good, which obviously isn't true. But for whatever reason, there's never this grassroots movement or there's never this campaign that we see for even campaign finance reform when it comes to the ethics laws. And it's sort of bewildering to me because, you know, this stuff is probably more worthy of being looked into than some of the campaign finance allegations that we've looked at in the past.
On Point, listeners, you've just heard Jim VandeHei, who's the Washington Post man on Capitol Hill and author yesterday of a very, very interesting piece about the kind of unwritten detente that exists between the Republican and Democratic parties in terms of looking into each other's ethical lapses, saying that there is no public demand that ethics be investigated. Do you agree with that? Have you, on Point listeners, ever complained or about your congressman's ethics, either publicly or to a watchdog body? We'd like to hear about it. 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation. Jim, do you feel like you're crying in the wilderness?
Sometimes. And it's interesting because this has a lot of relevance here locally in the D.C. area. There's a Congressman, Jim Moran, in Northern Virginia, and there's been a lot of stories in our newspaper about him getting some very favorable and questionable loans from people that he later helped out legislatively. And we got one loan that was for nearly $500,000, and then a few weeks later sort of steps up his support for legislation that supported the bank that gave him the loan.
Jim, we're coming.
And it's like there's not necessarily a federal law on the books that says.
Jim, I have to interrupt you because we're coming up to the break, but I want to pick you up on the story of Representative Moran just after the break, so please stay with us. We're talking about ethics and maybe not maybe not investigating as closely as they should be investigated. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking in this hour about the House and Senate, the Congress, living, well, say, glass houses, throwing stones about ethical issues. It seems to me that neither side is willing to investigate the ethics of the others, and we're talking about this subject with Jim Vandehei, who's the congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Just before the break, Jim, we were talking about Congressman Moran. And I wonder if you could just go into some real detail about James P. Moran. And
he's a moderate Democrat from Northern Virginia. He's had in the past, I think this is now the third example of him getting, he's always had some financial problems on his own. So he's needed money either for investing or, you know, to help out on different personal items. And his most recent example was he took a $450,000 loan from MBNA Corporation shortly before he intensified his support for legislation, bankruptcy legislation that the company was backing. Now, my point earlier was that there's no federal law that would be sort of an airtight case for someone to bring charges against him saying that he did something illegal. However, there's ethics laws in the House that prohibit members from using their position to get gifts or to get favorable treatment when it comes to you know, say, loans in this case. So it's something that most people take a look at, especially people who follow the ethics process, and say the ethics committee should be taking a close look at this. Maybe they'll find out that he did nothing improper, but at the very least, they should be investigating it, according to most people that follow this process.
Yeah, I have in front of me something we printed out from the web. This is a letter from the Congressional Accountability Project from the year 2000, noting a story in the Washington Post, perhaps you wrote it, that James Moran received a $25,000 unsecured, low-cost, open-ended loan from a lobbyist, a registered lobbyist.
Right.
And, you know, you sit back and you think, well, hang on a moment. I mean, what is the difference between a $25,000 unsecured, low-cost, open-ended loan? Open-ended, I assume, means that, you know, you can take 150 years to pay it back.
Precisely.
and just being given a sack full of $25,000 bills.
That's a question that the Ethics Committee should probably be answering. And that happened 2 years before this, or, you know, about 2 years before this loan to MBN. From MBNA, which is $450,000. So, I mean, this is two instances. It's something that clearly appears to possibly run afoul of House ethics laws, yet it's not being investigated.
Okay. Well,
this is something that, I mean, it's sort of the heart of democracy and sort of the the internal checks and balances of our congressional system, and that we've got to protect to make sure that lawmakers aren't coming here and sort of using public resources to pad their own pocket. And that's the House Ethics Committee's job, is to watch over and to make sure that none of that stuff is taking place.
All right. Well, earlier today, I spoke with Howard Berman, who's a Democrat from California, and he's the ranking member on the House Committee on Standards of Official Conduct. And I asked him about your article, and I asked him about the state of ethical play on Capitol Hill.
There has been for the past 5 years, 5.5 years now, a concerted effort to keep the ethics process above the partisan warfare that naturally goes on in a partisan body like the House of Representatives, particularly when the margin of the majority is so narrow, and that in a variety of ways, through rules changes, and secondly, through the commitment both of the party leaderships and the members of the Ethics Committee, a desire, one, to look at cases as objectively as possible, and to detach ourselves as much as humanly possible from the partisan implications of a particular ethics investigation. What the story in the Washington Post fails to mention is that the Ethics Committee, as a regular process through its staff and its membership, review all kinds of information that comes to it, from published reports in the media, written and on the television news, from outside information mailed or delivered to the committee, and from internal inquiries made to the committee, we have the power and, in fact, the obligation to self-initiate investigations where rule violations appear to have occurred.
In the last session, how many investigations did you or inquiries were you involved in?
Well, a number, some of which have became public, many of which did not become public or are underway now. And I'm somewhat limited in my ability to discuss this by our own obligation to confidentiality. But all I can assure you, both you and your listening public, is that the number of matters we are investigating are far greater than the number of items made public.
That was the Honorable Howard Berman, who's a California Democrat and the ranking Democrat on the House Committee on Standards of Official Conduct. And Jim VandeHei, what do you say to that? I mean,
well, there's a couple of problems. One is the House Ethics Committee is by far and away the most secretive committee in all of Congress. Nobody knows what they're doing behind closed doors. Mr. Berman says that they're taking a look at all these cases, and they very well may be doing that. We have no idea, because none of that information, unless they take action, is ever made public. So we have no idea what deliberations are taking place, and these guys are sworn to secrecy, and very, very rarely do you get a leak or get any inside information about what's happening in the committee. Secondly, in cases where they have taken action, it's only after it's become so apparent from outside investigations that they have to do something that they seem to take action. Like James Traficant was expelled after it went through the Ethics Committee. But a lot of these allegations have been out there for as long as 18 years. People knew what was going on with Jim Traficant. They knew what allegations were out there. They knew what evidence existed. But they never acted until essentially they were forced to, and it was a foregone conclusion that he was going to jail anyway. So, of course, they're going to expel him from Congress. And that's part of the problem with the ethics process. And it's a very uncomfortable position for Mr. Berman and other members to be in, because they're policing their friends, essentially.
Okay. I'd like to bring into the conversation now Damon Chappie, who's senior staff writer for Roll Call. And how do we characterize Roll Call, Damon Chappie? Online, on the page, it's the source of news for political junkies, I guess is the best way to do it.
Right. We cover Congress and politics. Pretty thoroughly.
Pretty thoroughly. You're being modest. What do you make of what you've heard so far, and particularly what Howard Berman was just saying?
Well, I think I agree with Jim. The problem is that there's no accountability. It's a completely closed system. There's no transparency whatsoever. We have no idea what they're doing, if they're doing anything. And generally, when we do find something, it's because there's been a great deal of public attention to the matter, which sort of leads you to the conclusion that they only act when there's a great deal of public pressure to act.
Is there I'm just wondering, I've got something in front of me here that indicates that for a long time, our Congress sort of acted without these committees. Has politics got sleazier, do you think, Damon, in the last quarter century, or is it just finally addressing a longstanding problem?
Well, no. I think politics is actually a lot cleaner than it used to be. You know, the stories that you hear about in the old days of the cash being handed over in paper bags, I don't think that happens. And I think that most members are aware of the ethics rules and of keeping in line with proper behavior, and try to adhere to that. So I think that there is, you know, they recognize the significance of having a clean sort of operation. So, I mean, the ethics committees have been in existence for, well, the House has been in for about 30 years, and the Senate, I guess, is for about 25 years.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Joe is on the line.
Yeah, hi. I had a question for Jim. Essentially, is he truly surprised that there seems to be a lack of enthusiasm on behalf of the public to really go after these ethics issues? I mean, doesn't he feel as though potentially people feel as though they have more important issues to address right now, whether it be defense of the country or lack of, you know, economic stagnation that's going on out here right now? I mean, it seems as though ethics seem to slow things down, whereas what we should be doing is trying to rev up the economy and defend our country. And maybe these things could wait until later.
Jim Vandehei.
Well, I agree that there are probably more important and more pressing concerns facing the country right now, but I don't think that that would be a valid excuse for ignoring the ethics process. By no means could lawmakers not be watchdogs and be investigating these other members and still do the rest of their business. There's nothing that would preclude them from doing that. So I don't think that we can fight the war on terrorism and try to do whatever Congress can to try to bring some stability to the stock market and at the same time do the constitutional duty of being watchdogs over members and their behavior.
Joe, let me ask you, what do you mean by slowing down the process?
Well, I mean, as sad as it may be, you know, I can only speak for myself being a small business owner, but, you know, the way that I understand politics has always involved a certain degree of, for lack of a better term, corruption. I mean, when the construction company greases the palm of the local politician to get the contract, they get the contract, the roads get built, union jobs get created. You know, it keeps things moving, and it keeps things moving economically. When both parties sit there and look at each other and say, well, you know, am I going to be the first one to investigate your ethics? And they both look at each other and are afraid of what's going to get uncovered. These deals can't happen. And subsequently, we have people losing jobs. And from my standpoint, you know, business isn't getting done.
And your business is the construction business?
To some extent, yes. I'm related to that business.
Right. Damon, I mean, is that a common thought, do you think, amongst the representatives there on the Hill, that that there's an understanding that grown-ups know that there's a certain amount of corruption necessary to, what can we say, grease the wheels of government?
Well, I don't think anybody would ever admit that who was elected. But I think the other side is, you know, if you have a corrupt system, it's not a level playing field. And so it keeps good ideas from perhaps moving or other projects from being built that are probably maybe more worthwhile because you have influence that has a special sort of favor attached to it that gets attention from a person who has power. And the ethics process is designed to level the playing field. That's the idea of it, so that you have sort of equal access for all constituencies to come forward and that representatives are going to look at them and treat them somewhat fairly.
Joe, is that a valid point?
Very true. I think that, you know, politics has never been a level playing field. I just think that's what the public seems to understand. You can introduce as many clean election laws as you want, but the fact of the matter is that the people with the most money get in office. And last I checked, public office salaries were never that high. The money comes from somewhere. And that somewhere, you know, is typically based upon individual and business concerns.
Thank you for joining us, Joe. Thank you for that point of view. Terry is on the line.
Hi.
Hi, Terry.
How are you?
Fine.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My point is, especially based on a comment that an earlier caller had, the ethics in Congress is directly linked to our current economy and economic crisis, particularly with issues surrounding Enron and Tyco and scandals by top corporate executives who have very close ties with our government. And I can tell you as an MBNA customer, longtime customer, I've not been offered anywhere near the deals that some of our members of Congress obviously have. And I really don't understand why Congress doesn't understand that ethics and credibility are absolutely crucial to get our economy moving again. No one trusts the system, particularly where there's been a lot of corruption come to light recently. And if our elected members of government are on the take, why should have anyone have confidence in the system that they can restore the economy to any type of working order?
Damon Chappie, would you like to respond to that comment?
Well, I think that's a good point. Trust is the coin of the realm. If you don't have trust, the system really breaks down at that point. And if you can't have faith that you're being treated fairly and getting good representation, then you know you're not going to participate in the system any longer. And you can see what happens. I mean, that's, you know, probably a large part of the problem today.
It's interesting that there were two calls with almost diametrically opposed views on the way into this conversation. But to what degree, I wonder, does Joe's point about tolerating a certain amount of corruption, you were saying, Damon, that actually politics is cleaner now than it has been ever before, possibly. Is there a balance that has to be struck between the realities? I mean, we think of representative government as being in some ivory tower, but it isn't. I mean, it is representative. It represents our society, it's a business society, a society where, you know, people take backhanders and get business. I just wonder if you think that democracy actually does work with a bit of, well, what can you say?
Well, politics is about relationships, and you know that's and politics is about building coalitions and building groups that can work together towards a common goal. Now, whether or not you bring in money as a factor into that, or gifts, or bribes, or whatever you want to call it, that's a different kind of element that changes the dynamic of the political equation, and it provides an opportunity for the people who can provide those kind of things to the members. They get a special advantage over ordinary people or people who don't play that way, who get locked out of the system, who get locked out of the committee room, get locked out of the member's office.
I have time to ask Jim Vandehei one last question.
Okay.
And Jim, that's, you know, do you think after watching this process all these years that isn't it just a little bit better to when Congress is concentrated on legislation rather than scoring partisan points by investigating ethical lapses? There are so many that could be investigated, and it does clog up the system, doesn't it?
I think when it's done for purely political reasons, it clogs up the system. But I don't think that should be, you know, just having to get legislation done should not be an excuse for inaction on the ethics front. I think that there's plenty of time. Members of Congress are 5 days a week, you know, 300, you know, around the clock. So basically, I think there's plenty of time to do the legislation, but also to keep a close eye on the ethics of members. I don't. That one caller had sort of talked about corruption being a necessary component of democracy or of how Congress functions. I just don't think that's true. I think that contracts can be made, roads can be built, and all that stuff can be done on the up and up. It doesn't necessarily have to be influenced adversely by ethical lapses.
Jim Vandehei, thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us. Jim Vandehei is the Washington Post congressional reporter, and his article about ethic probes declining on the Hill. You can catch it online at the Post website, and it makes for interesting reading. Thanks very much for joining us. We're going to carry on the conversation after the break, listeners. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, to join in the discussion about how closely Congress should scrutinize itself in terms of ethics. You're listening to On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking about Congress's reluctance to look at its own ethical lapses at a time when it's hauling up CEOs by the gross to Capitol Hill to look at their ethical lapses. And I'm joined in the conversation now by John M. Barry, who's the author of several books about politics, including Power Plays, Politics, Football, and Other Blood Sports. Good evening, John.
Good evening.
We were getting at history a bit in the last segment. Just give us the history of the movement for ethical investigation, as it were, on Capitol Hill.
A couple things. First, the Ethics Committee was really created more to protect members than to investigate them. It's not like the Internal Affairs Division of a police department, which does nothing but investigate policemen. The members of the committee serve other functions. They're on other committees. They have their own issues that they want to advance. If they go around investigating their colleagues, their own priorities are not going to move anywhere. So that's one of the problems. The other thing is they think that public sunshine sort of is the best defense. You were talking earlier about Jim Moran. The fact is those articles have been in the Washington Post, and Moran is a suburban, represents a suburban Washington constituency. So the feeling is his Republican opponents have that information. They can use it in the campaigns, and it's up to the voters to determine, and it should be up to the voters more than anybody else, to determine who represents them. I'd like to make, I was listening earlier to some of your callers, and just to provide some context, you know, Jim Wright's the only Speaker of the House who was forced to resign over ethical questions, although the reality is that was pure politics. Gingrich himself said 2 years before Wright resigned that he's a useful keystone to a much bigger structure. And he said Gingrich said all he wanted to do was get an investigator in there with subpoena powers and look around and figured there must be something because he'd been in politics for 30 years and he was from Texas. But the reality was there wasn't anything. Nonetheless, and the committee never actually gave Wright a trial, and they told him, in effect, behind the scenes, he was never going to get a trial. They were going to hang him out there in the public arena and just drag things on and never give him a trial. But to back up even further, when he first went to Congress in 1954, Wright made $70,000 a year as a 30-year-old businessman, and congressmen were then making $12,500 a year. He did not get into politics for money, and most of the members of Congress do not get into politics for the money. They are driven by other things. A surprising number actually intended to be ministers. That of course, the church isn't doing so well at the moment, but they have different motives. Money does not drive them. They may be corrupted by ambition, but they are not corrupted by money.
Yeah, it's interesting. We were talking about ethical lapses, and of course, the biggest bloodletting of all was the impeachment trial of Bill Clinton, and that was moral, not ethical. And the body
I'm
count.
I'm not sure how you.
Well, I mean,
draw a line between morals and ethics.
Well, I mean, it's a question of no one accused Bill Clinton of taking money. Bill Clinton was brought up because he lied to the American people about his sexual life in the Oval Office. And so I'm making that distinction, I think, and also noting that the body count on that was, I think, the Republicans lose one prospective speaker, and Newt Gingrich was essentially made to look a hypocrite because of his own quite similar moral lapses. And Bill Clinton managed to finish his term quite popular. Damon Chappie, I'm wondering, do you agree with John Barry's reading of history?
Well, I certainly agree with his assessment that the ethics process is about politics in Congress. It's not about ethics. It's about politics. And I think that's been shown over and over again, and certainly was well documented in his book on Jim Wright's final years in Congress.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Kathleen is on the line.
Hi. I wanted to comment on what someone had said and ask a question about why the public doesn't respond. And I was thinking about the Clinton scandals, and I think that the public was very turned off by what was considered an ethical scandal where they saw a lot of hypocrisy. So when there isn't a public outcry when you hear the term ethics, it may well be that the public is thinking, here we go again. I certainly think we need to have it, and I appreciate the investigation of the financial scandals like MBNA. But when I heard the topic tonight, I thought, oh, no. You know, going to be, you know, another embarrassing expose about the private.
I'm sorry, you broke up a little there, Kathleen. What was going to be embarrassing?
Another expose sexual about, you know, what many of us have difficulty listening to on the air, feel it's an invasion of privacy.
Right. And what's your question for Damon Chappie or John Barry?
Does he feel that that contributes to the lack of public outcry about, you know, the ethics scandal in Congress?
Damon Chappie, do you think that there is a bit of, you know, continued fallout from the chaos created by the Clinton impeachment?
Sure. There's a general sense. I think it's pretty well documented that the public thinks that a lot of politicians, most politicians, are crooks and do something bad and are corrupt. And they tune it out when a story is written about someone doing some sort of ethical transgression. It can be ignored because it's, well, they're all doing that, you know, and that's a general attitude these days.
John Barry.
Well, I'd agree that the attitude toward politicians is not exactly positive. I mean, it was Mark Twain who said they were the only native criminal class in the United States.
Yeah. When did he write that?
Well, 1870s, I guess. Fairly early in his career, I believe.
When he was still covering Congress.
I didn't know that he covered Congress.
Oh, he like everybody else, spent some time in Washington. You think he was just clever enough to keep on moving? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Marv is calling from Fontana, Wisconsin.
Yes, hi, how are you guys this evening?
Okay.
Listen, my point is that a few years ago there was a big push about term limits. And what I quite don't understand is that these guys are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, in some case millions of dollars, to earn a minuscule amount per year than what they're normally doing in the public sector. Why aren't term limits pushed more? And maybe this would be a way to keep more of the corruption out of politics.
That's an interesting idea. John Barry, do you think...
Well, there has actually been tremendous turnover in the last 15 years in the House of Representatives. The term limit push was essentially a Republican partisan move because the Democrats held office for such a long period of time and did control the House for well over 30 years. And they felt if there was turnover, that automatically meant they had a good shot at getting in. Now, a lot of the Republicans were elected in 94 swearing they would limit themselves to 6 or 8 or 10 years. Many of them have broken that pledge already. A few of them have kept it and have left Congress. But if you look at the numbers, it is a pretty volatile institution now, at least compared to what it was 15 years ago.
Yes, John. I'm sorry, you dropped out as well. So, do you want to finish that thought? Right, Damon Chappie. What do you think about Marv's idea that one way of limiting corruption in the absence of thorough investigation in house would be to have term limits, and that way people wouldn't get those kinds of fabulous pork barrel power bases?
Well, I don't know if that's the answer to this problem. There are good legislators who are very good in what they do, and they care a great deal about the process of legislation and are not ethically challenged. And should they just be turned out of office for some reason like that? I don't know if that's the answer.
Yeah, and I think that's a very good point. And I think when the Republicans did take control of the House, they put in a rule that it's only a House rule. The chairman could only serve a limited number of terms. And they have kept to that. And I think that goes a long way toward cutting into some of the institutional power bases that occur. But the reality is, in several state legislatures that have instituted term limits, the results have not been what people have wanted, and they've been pretty much what the critics of the term limit movement have said would happen. What you get is staff and lobbyists get more power than elected officials. Right.
Hmm. I wonder, the one thing we haven't spoken about in terms of ethics is the fact is that there's so much money sloshing around that it seems to me that the place where you start the discussion of ethics is already probably deeply tainted. At least that's how it seems from out here, not inside the Beltway, and you guys are, you know, Washington-based writers and reporters. Is it even possible to consider having a relatively clean legislature when so many hundreds of thousands, actually not that, it's an old figure, millions of dollars are required simply to get to the place in terms of fundraising.
Well,
anybody can jump on
that
question.
Well, I mean, you've gotten to the real point. I mean, that's far more important than, to me anyway, than the personal corruption in the sense of somebody sticking money in his pocket. Because that affects public policy, and those people are there to do public policy. Now, obviously, Congress just passed a major campaign finance reform. In the past, those things haven't worked so well. This one's a little bit tighter. The FEC is already probably playing games with that, but I believe Mr. Chappie probably has a better idea of what's going on there than I do.
Damon, do you have a better idea?
Well, I think just taking a step back, you know, I said earlier in the program that Congress is cleaner and that you don't have the $25,000 in paper bags anymore, but you do have the $25,000 checks, you know, that are being handed over, and it's sort of a legalized way of gaining influence, and that's the system that we've have now, and we have a new campaign finance law that's going to take effect right the day after the election, November 6th, and we'll see how it works, and we'll see how the courts interpret it. I think there's going to be some major changes to the law from the courts. I don't think they're just going to sit there and let this go through without a little bit of tinkering, and probably a lot of tinkering.
What I'm just coming to the end of the process here, the end of the hour, guys, and I'm wondering, would you expect to see this, at least one or two other ethical investigations making news in the autumn in advance of the election? And if you do, could you tell us what, Damon?
I don't know. I mean, there's several House members that Jim had identified in his story that may come up, and would be much more a matter of the local races. I think it is interesting in New Jersey, the Torricelli case, which was just ended with the Senate Ethics Committee, and he was severely admonished for taking a number of gifts, and it has affected him, at least. And the latest polls have shown that his numbers have gone down quite a bit, and his challenger, who is a no name, is very little known in the state, has come even with Torricelli.
And just quickly, because you are coming to the end of the hour, I suppose the name that a lot of us would like to know about is Tom DeLay, House Majority Whip now. If the Democrats regain control of the House of Representatives, he won't be the majority whip, but he'll be a senior Republican figure. Is there any chance that the Democrats will actually finally go after Tom DeLay?
Well, they've tried in the past. They did file a racketeering lawsuit against him, and it's always possible. DeLay is a fascinating political figure.
Damon Chappie, thank you very much for joining us. John Barry, thank you very much for joining us. And thanks also to Jim VandeHei of The Washington Post, who started off this conversation, which you can continue online at onpointradio.org. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point.
This is W.